Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data science, drinking, and awesomeness. It is time for our top data-related news from the past week. As always, if it seems like we do not know what we're talking about, it is because we are drunk. Links to all the stories we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter, at @partiallyd. My name is Chris Albin, and as always, with me is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan. First announcement, we are available everywhere. We are on iTunes, we are on SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. Second, please, if you listen to us on iTunes, review us. It is a great help to the show, and, you know, we love you guys, and we would like some of that love back, because love is a circle. Third, we want some feedback. If you have comments, complaints, cool data stories, shoot us an email, hello@partiallyderivative.com, or tweet at us @partiallyd. Finally, most important, beers. Jonathan, what are you drinking?
All right, so this week, I am coming at you with another Texas. I'm sure it's an Austin beer. So Yellow Rose is a delicious IPA from the Lone Pint Brewery. It's kind of malty, very smooth, a little fruity. But the actual Yellow Rose, the thing that gave this beer its name, is at this like skanky strip club out by the airport.
That sounds not really wonderful, but I suspect the beer is wonderful.
The beer is great.
This week, I'm actually taking a break from beer, not because I don't love beer, but because actually my pantry is empty. But I have 25 bottles of wine in my pantry, so this week I'm drinking a J. Opie Malbec from Mendoza, Argentina. Anyone who knows in the show knows that I tend to drink a lot on the show, and we've been talking a while before the show, and I have almost finish off the bottle. So there's a lot of wine going on in this action.
I was about to make a joke about how the show just got pretentious because now you can talk about like the tannins and the timber of the wine and say that it has nice legs or whatever you say about wine. But it turns out that actually you're just drinking all of it really fast, like a high school student.
That's exactly right. It is. This isn't a classy move. This is definitely someone standing behind the liquor store with like a box of wine, putting their face under it, just accepting it.
Oh, the
story. All right, let's begin the show. First story goes to you.
All right, so as we've just discovered, out of the two of us, I'm definitely the classy gentleman, and you're the wino. So in keeping with this reputation that I've established, I'm going to start this week's episode with a segment that I'm calling Your Priest is Watching You Pee. Smart-ass gadgets from a data-driven dystopia. So the blog post that our segment is based on actually comes from a guy called Zachary Crockett, who writes for Priceonomics. Now, Zach, if I can call him Zach, is covering a Dublin art exhibition featuring the work of Daniel Toomey. Now, you're probably thinking, what does some art exhibition have to do with data science? And the truth is, not very much. But the art is actually pretty cool, and it's technology-focused, and a couple of the pieces actually have something to do with numbers. So, the artist, this guy Daniel Toomey, was interested in the idea of the quantified self.
Me too. Yes,
of course. You've got the Fitbit, and you're tracking your steps. And
I also have the thing that the Wi-Fi-enabled scale that I weigh myself on.
Wow, that makes me think even less of you. But but this whole deal with the quantified self, right? I think that the artist is actually kind of making the same joke that we are, right? He's interested in the gap between what we can actually quantify and what really, you know, makes us who we are, right? And so I'm not going to get all metaphysical about this, like what does it mean to be a person, or like, you know, what makes me like me, or whatever, right? Art stuff. But for real, I love how we're actually all merging our digital and physical lives, right? All the little household gadgets like your Wi-Fi scale or smartwatches or this big Internet of Things. It all means we're basically living every moment immersed in data, right? And I think this sounds scary for some people, but for me, it means we can finally stop talking about the online world versus the like quote unquote real world and start exploring how we move through life with all this data and the technologies that understand that data kind of like partners, right? So we're not just thinking of our technology as tools. Anyway, so maybe that's all in the future. But in the meantime, this whole quantified life we're trying to live is frankly coming up a little short. No offense to your Fitbit. And I think that's what...
Wi-Fi scale, damn it.
Wi-Fi scale. Like, if Wi-Fi is involved, you will definitely be the fittest man in your
exactly
postal
true.
District.
Until my scale kills me.
Right, until the internet goes out. And then and then you're fat. But the example that, like, so this artist created a bunch of stuff, right? That was not actually practical, like the stuff that you're talking about. But he created almost like gag technologies or real life objects that kind of made fun of this relationship that we have with the technologies that we use. And so he created a headstone, right? Like the thing that you put at the end of at the end of someone's grave, right? The little stone that says, like, here lies whoever. But instead of the person's name on the headstone, it has their Twitter handle. And instead of an epitaph, like the little inscription that you write, like, here lies Chris. He was never quite as smart or as well liked as Jonathan. Rest in peace. And like on the epitaph, it's just a bunch of mundane social media stats, like 672 Twitter followers, 92% positive feedback on eBay. 184 Tinder matches, like all this kind of stuff, right? And the best piece in the whole exhibit, by far the best one, and this is why I came up with my awesome title, it's a cross with a camera on it so you can wear it and, like, you can life cast yourself to a priest that witnesses your every sin in real time. And the in the exhibit, there's a little text message conversation that goes with it, like right on the wall or whatever. And the conversation is between a guy and his priest, and the priest is like, I saw that, Tony. Give me 5 Hail Marys and 2 Our Fathers. And then Tony responds, and he's like, fair enough, Father. We'll do that right now. And, like, I love this stuff, right? I mean, it's whatever. It's silly, and I guess it's a little bit of a technophobe art exhibit, and that's okay. I'll give Mr. Toomey a pass on this one because I'm kind of enamored with the fact that technology and data are so mainstream that people are making art about it and putting it in gallery showings, right? Like, you can remember this, right? We're about the same age. Do you remember when the entire internet was like those weird bulletin boards?
Absolutely, which I participated in a lot.
So did I. I thought it was so cool. And everyone's big picture metaphor for the internet was like, imagine reading a book from any library in the world. And like way later than that, like for the first half of my life, maybe people used email if they were really tech savvy. And then if you were a geeky teenager, perhaps you used AOL chat like a boss and made really cool like GeoCities sites. And like that was like 10, 15 years ago. We've gone from that to this totally plausible scenario in which we want the world to remember us based on the number of Twitter followers we'd amassed before death. And like what is cool about it, though, is that that means the next 10 years are going to be even more awesome. Like it's almost like it kind of blows the mind. So get excited. That's the thing. Well, let's all get excited.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Next story, the math of March Madness. All right. So this next story comes from Jordan Ellisberg. And it is about a topic that we hit on last week, namely March Madness. So now listeners might remember that last week we talked about how data science has started to invade the world of sweaty locker rooms and Gatorade. I'm a grape man myself. And if you're one of those lime people, just get out because grape is
Chris,
the way to go.
It's a difference between grape Gatorade and wine. Like
they're not both so amazing.
But you don't drink that when you play basketball. So you may be a great man, but I don't think that makes you like an athlete.
I'm a wino in all areas. But all right, back to the story. In the article, you know, that we talked about last week, I mentioned how I love following sports analysts, even though I'm not a huge sports fan. And one of the reasons is that particularly this month, they are go crazy. It is like what a presidential election would be to me, a political scientist. That's what March Madness is to them. It is so cool to actually go on Twitter and follow them and watch them just absolutely, you know, go crazy this month about using the data in really interesting ways. And one thing that I've seen them do, which I've been starting to follow, has been talking about, well, probably like obsessing about a certain very friendly competition. And that competition is Kaggle's March Machine Learning Mania. And for those who don't know, Kaggle is a machine learning competition website. It's where companies or nonprofits post challenges to data scientists to compete to solve, say, building a better movie recommendation algorithm or something like that, right? That's sort of a very famous example. But they post these challenges, people compete, and the winner sometimes gets a prize, sometimes just gets a pat on the back, whatever. But it's kind of fun to sort of watch it happen. And the goal of this March Madness competition, whose prize is $15,000, never mind, like, just to put that out there, is to predict the outcome of every single game in the tournament, or to get as close as possible. And this New York Times article about this actually focuses on two people in particular, Gregory Matthews, a.k.a. at Stats in the Wild on Twitter, and Michael Lopez, a.k.a. Stats by Lopez.
And they found the correlation was having stats in your Twitter handle.
That's exactly. I need to add stats in my Twitter handle. I would do much better in these tournaments then.
$15,000, man. You should change that up.
So they are the two people who won last year's challenge. And how did they win it? You know, what kind of incredible data science black magic did they use to coax out the correct prediction from the data? Well, it was, you know, just wait for it, logistic regression. Probably the first thing that you learn in your second stats class, right? So, you know, the two are admittedly statistics professors. They use this very basic approach and only two data sources. One, which was the sort of bookie point spread. So like, you know, if you're going to bet money, like what the sort of point spread is for those. And this offense defense efficiency rating developed by another sports analyst. But they just use these two basic readily available pieces of data plus logistic regression, which is a very basic technique, to win the tournament last year, which is
Wait a second. When they won the tournament, like I totally get that there are stats that would give you some kind of odds on a basketball game that are probably better than whatever, like the rabid enthusiasm for one's former university that usually determines how people predict those kind of outcomes. But okay. Did they really guess every game? Because inevitably there's some like random college that nobody's ever heard of that's like Northwest East Nowheresville State. No offense if that's your team. Right? And like they beat some massive college that basically, you know, the basketball team pays for the entire university because it's so successful, right? Like one of those huge programs like Duke or something. And so did they get them all right? Like, did they guess every single game like the Kaggle competition asked them to do?
That is actually a great point. They didn't. And
the
idea is that they got the closest to perfection. But I don't think anybody's ever got to perfection. And there's actually a really great quote I just saw where someone was asked, hey, you know, how do you add spontaneity into your recommendation engine? And the answer was, well, bugs, right? And the idea that you're never perfectly right and that error is the spontaneity part of it is almost where this is, right? Of course, there's going to be small teams that beat massive teams because that's the way it works, right? All you can get is a probability that some team is going to win some particular match. You can't guess every single one. But they got closer than anyone else. And you know, what is so cool about this, and the reason I bring up this story is for two reasons. First, it is freaking cool to see a New York Times article about a competition that you've vicariously been following for weeks. And the amount of sheer passion and, dare I say, obsession that these guys have for this Kaggle competition is so just awesome to watch, and it's freaking, you know, it's inspiring to watch, right? Like, I want to go work with data every single time I watch them at like midnight, just hammering away and talking about the next probability and the next prediction that they're doing. And I actually really regret not entering the competition myself. Not that I actually know anything about sports or would have any chance of coming close to winning, but I kind of want to enter it just to be part of their conversation about it, which is kind of like a great, you know, part of data science that we can all participate in it together. But the second reason, and probably the far more important reason, or at least the more serious reason, is that Lopez and Matthews' attempt last year did so well with a very basic statistical technique. And I think that highlights a really important point for me. And a point that I just, it is my pet peeve in the world of data science. That, you know, the more quote unquote advanced statistical techniques, do not necessarily provide the best method to you all the time, right? And I think people get really confused at this point. So statistics is typically taught from simple to advanced, right? So your first statistics class typically ends with doing a linear regression, and then maybe the next class starts to talk about categorical variables and ordinal variables, and then maybe the next one talks about time series, and then maybe the next one talks about Bayesian. Like, there's this very, like, march from relatively simple analysis to relatively complicated analysis. However, you know, the appropriateness and the quality of the analysis is really unrelated to the order in which it's taught. Rather, analyses are taught from easy to difficult, but the analysis should actually be thought of as more of sort of tools in a workshop. So by analogy, let's say you're learning woodworking, let's say. The first thing you're going to learn is like a $5 handsaw, and let's say the last thing you learn is like a $50,000 robotic water woodcutter or something like that. That doesn't mean that the handsaw is less useful. And it doesn't mean that the woodcutter or the robot water cutter thing should be what you should use for every single cutting task. All it means is one was more difficult to learn than the other. And there's going to be so many times where the right tool is that handsaw, and there's other times where it's the, you know, robotic water cutter. And statistics is the same way. It's about picking the correct tool for that particular type of analysis, not picking the one that is the most difficult to do, which a lot of people end up falling into that trap. And it makes life a lot more difficult for people.
That said, if you're entering a Kegel competition, maybe you want to try out something new, right? Because the kind of answers that you're looking for in your job or whatever are kind of straightforward, and people expect you to get there as fast as you can and to be as accurate as you can. So you use a tried and true technique. But then when you go to do a competition for fun, now you get to use the cool stuff. Like, why would you not bring out the $50,000 robotic water saw?
Actually, I kind of like that approach where you're like, okay, so someone is going to do the basic one, so I'm going to do the weird one, right? Like, I'm going to brute force some genetic approach to it and see if that happens, because that's my only chance. Like, it's like a long shot. It's like a Hail Mary of analysis. That's kind of cool.
Totally.
It doesn't matter how well you did, but if everyone, you know, like, let's say you're doing sports and everyone used, like, who won the last game, and you do something like what the coach said in the interview afterwards.
That and or, like, the position of Saturn relative to the number of students.
Did it rain in Milwaukee for all NBA games?
Totally. Or, like, that octopus that predicted all the World Cup games.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Like, let's figure out what that guy's doing now. All right, moving on. So our next story is the truth about traffic. And the truth is that I hate it. I mean, I think everybody hates traffic.
I mean, you live in Austin. You must be used to it.
Okay. That was a that was a sick burn. And, like, it's not that it's a waste of time, right? Because, of course, it's a waste of time. But more than that, like, it makes me upset with humans as a species. Like, why did we choose to build all of our houses somewhere other than our offices? And then why did we choose to run a society where everyone needs to travel to those offices at the same time? It's like, you just sit there looking at that and going, I don't know. I mean, what could go wrong? What could go wrong in this system? And, like, as I sit there in traffic, wondering whether or not I'm, like, wasting the best years of my life stationary in this, like, little plastic bubble, I try and imagine how traffic works. Is it really as simple as there being too many cars on the road at the same time? I mean, surely that's part of it, right? But it feels like a much more complex system. There are cars entering the highway and leaving the highway. Sometimes you have to stop altogether, but not all lanes stop at the same time. I can never tell which lane is the best. And that just seems to imply that the road is not actually at capacity somehow. So we're all just stopping for no reason. And I know, right? Like, I can feel it, that it's one of those problems that I just don't have the right perspective on, right? Like, I don't have enough data for my perspective inside one car out of the thousands of cars to really understand what's going on. And, like, it pisses me off, man. So that's why when I stumbled onto this visualization from Lewis Leahy, who's a transportation engineering, like, PhD candidate, it was like the wool was lifted from my eyes. And now, it's actually kind of an old post, right? So, like, Lewis published it back in September, but Nathan Yao over at Flowing Data featured it this week. And so, like, I just discovered it. So, like, Hat tip to Nathan. And Lewis visualizes a bunch of traffic patterns. First, the intuitive one, where there is an area that's actually too small for all the cars that want to access it. So those cars have to form a queue, and in traffic engineering language, that's called a bottleneck. But then he gets into gridlock. This is like another term, right? It's another traffic engineering term. And gridlock is the vicious cycle of bottlenecks that ruin all of our lives. And like he simulates it with this interactive visualization that shows how one bottleneck leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. And like you can watch as cars enter and exit the simulation and see how traffic builds up. It's like this little wave rippling through all the cars, each one slowed down a little bit more and a little bit more until eventually cars are forced to stop and then they all accumulate, right? Okay, so now we know why it happens, and that's a little bit better, but the experience of sitting in traffic still sucks. And so maybe we should go do something about it, right? And what's cool is that by using algorithms to simulate how traffic builds up, scientists discovered, I guess a while ago, that it was theoretically possible to solve gridlock, like make it go away. But the way that Lewis puts it in his paper is like he says it's gently controlling accumulation, which in other words just means it means causing bottlenecks on purpose, right? Deliberately slowing traffic at just the right place at just the right time. And so when you use bottlenecks strategically, you can stop the vicious cycle and therefore prevent gridlock, which is the super painful thing that we all want to avoid. And even cooler is that now with smart cars or maybe even self-driving cars and other connected devices that know where and when we are, like in time and space, that kind of real-time traffic control, it doesn't need to be theoretical anymore. So Leahy imagines a system of signals and exit ramp meters and whatever that manipulate accumulation at certain points in a highway or some other traffic system, and they create bottlenecks, right? But ultimately, they allow us to get where we're going a lot faster. And so I think that if Leahy and scientists like him can actually solve this problem, I want to invent a new category of Nobel Prize. like the double Nobel. And then I want to give him three of them.
Talking like towards what Leahy's doing, a lot of people who listen to this podcast live in the Bay Area, I'm absolutely certain. And if you go over the Bay Bridge, you go through from Oakland to San Francisco, you go through the pay point, and then you come up to a traffic light that has you wait for like half a second, and then it turns green. So there's like 20 traffic lights all in a row, and they're like blinking on like 3 second intervals or something like that.
Oh, that's it. That's it. That's exactly what he's talking about. Like deliberately slowing traffic with those kind of signals.
And that's exactly the point, right? For a long time, so I used to commute from San Francisco to my PhD program in Davis, and I would drive to that thing all the time. And I was like, why in the world are you having me wait at this point? And I actually went and looked it up. Like, why are there traffic lights here that have me wait? Like, no joke, it has you wait for like 2 seconds. Like, it's like nothing. It's absolutely nothing. And it turns out that there's a lot of research behind this, that you should, it's totally great for you to wait 2 seconds because the flow across the bridge becomes better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, speaking of problems that are important and will change the face of humanity, story number 4, a Bayesian survival analysis of Game of Thrones. Okay.
Of course there's a Bayesian survival analysis for Game of Thrones.
I will say this up front. I promise you there will be no spoilers from me in what I'm about to say. However, there's definitely spoilers in the article that I'm going to talk about. So you're okay listening to this podcast. You're not okay actually reading the article. That I'm going to say up front because we have a no spoiler policy on this.
That's true. At the end, everybody dies. Oh, crap.
It's an asteroid. All right. So while I'm not a huge Game of Thrones uber nerd, I have read all the books multiple times. I have actually created an original data set from the storyline, which you can find on GitHub. The point is, I actually really do love things that combine Game of Thrones and data science. I think it's a really great universe to sort of explore and have fun with without a lot of consequences behind it. Because if you're wrong, you know, whatever.
And if you're wrong, Robb Stark loses.
Exactly.
more to the point, though, how can you say that you're not an uber nerd? You've read the books I quote, these are like tomes, man. You've read them multiple times and you created the data set, snort, based on Game of
Thrones.
You're an Uber nerd. Own it. Own it.
I'm a reader and I read a lot of books does not mean that I'm a particular fan of any one versus the other. But I have read a lot of it and I could totally cite a lot of Game of Thrones stuff. But back to the story. So Alan Downey is a computer science professor and also the author of a very popular book on statistics, which, as far as I know, is the only book that teaches basic statistics using Python.
Oh, it's the best book about statistics then.
So it's called Think Statistics. It's from O'Reilly. As an aside, the number of books that teach basic statistics using R is probably a dozen at this point. So point R. Just going to highlight that. But I really did like his book because it's nice to learn a language and learn statistics sort of at the same time and rehash it and enjoy it. So I thought it was a really cool book. I definitely own it. And he actually, you know, teaches a Bayesian statistics class, I think last quarter. And one of the assignments he gave his class was to do some interesting project. And so now, one thing George R.R. Martin, the author of the book series, and I don't think this is a spoiler, is famous for is killing off major characters. So basically, as soon as you grow to like a character, that guy is doomed. Like, that guy is so screwed.
It's like anybody that Don Draper sleeps with on Mad Men.
Exactly, like, right?
Definitely gonna die.
Exactly, yeah. So this week on his blog, Downey posted a class project from two of his students. One's Aaron Pierce and the other one's Ben Cayley. Sorry, Ben, I totally destroyed your last name. The two students actually used data scraped from the Game of Thrones wiki and used that sort of book data combined with this Bayesian method to predict, wait for it, characters were likely to die or survive in the forthcoming books. So there's five books in the series so far. There's seven going to be in total. So there's two left to do. And they did an analysis to see, you know, what were the chances of certain characters and certain types of characters in the future books. So the post itself goes into the methodologies that they used. But overall, what the students were looking at was how long did it take a type of character, say from a certain family or from a certain gender, to, you know, like to actually die in the series, or how long did they survive? And then from that, extrapolating the probabilities that a particular character of that group might fare in the future. So take for, you know, as a very quick fake example, there have been five books. There's two more to do. Imagine there was this House Albon, like a rich, powerful house, which, you know, George R.R. Martin, if you're listening, please do that. I think I would make a great character on a show. I probably can sword fight. Maybe. But I
was totally, you know, hypothetical, but actually Chris's like the pinnacle of Chris's dreams.
Exactly. Yeah. I will wear leather all the time. Chainmail. It'll be awesome. But back to the point, you have this House Albon that let's say has six characters, right? So there's at the start of the books, there's six, all dashing and rich, of course, because that's how it works. And each book, one character dies. So at the start of the first book, you have six. And the start of the second book, you have five, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, using this sort of basic analysis, at the start of the sixth book, that last Albon, right, the one who hasn't died, he's pretty screwed in this analysis. That's the sort of basic trend. You can see this downward trend from the first book to the last book. That's the kind of analysis that they're doing. And the post itself goes into individual characters, and which I'm not going to talk about because I won't spoil it for anyone. But I will give you some non-spoiler results. So first, women do solidly better than men, right? So if you're a woman character, you're more likely to survive your way all the way through than men. Sucks to be a man. Of all the characters in the book, nobles have a slightly better way of surviving than commoners. So if you're named as a character in the book and you're a noble, you do slightly better in the early books. But then towards the end, it starts to get less likely that that's an advantage.
Oh, you're really tiptoeing there. That's tiptoeing territory.
I think it's okay. But characters from minor families did significantly well for major characters. So that might be the last one. So I won't get close. I think that's okay. But needless to say, it's a really cool analysis. So if you actually have read through all the books, it's really cool to see. I actually think it's a great example of people doing combining Bayesian approaches with survival analyses. And it's because they describe it through an assignment, you can actually see them describing it in essentially layman's terms, right? Going through and not assuming that you know anything about how this works, describing it very basically. There's lots of great charts. It's very, very cool. I suggest you check it out. Also, if you want to survive in the Game of Thrones, I feel as a start, you probably shouldn't be written as a character in Game of Thrones because your chances of survival are infinitely worse.
Odds of dying are pretty bad, yeah.
But there are things you can do, and I like these kind of ways of exploring areas of fiction using data science. It's cool. Also, they're decent books, so there we go.
It is a bad idea to be a George R.R. Martin character, especially if you're from, you know, if you're a noble. Oh, no, if you're a commoner and you're a man, you're definitely going to die. But you're also going to die if you're a whale. And I'm teetering on the edge of making jokes that are probably going to make people upset. But this story actually comes from listener Paul Clammer, and I'm really glad that he sent it, right? Because as much as I'm joking about it, right? We used to talk about saving the whales all the time. That was like a trope for environmentalism, right? And because the environmental movement was really focused on protecting endangered species. And I'm sure, obviously, they still are. But at least in the mainstream, this conversation is always about climate change now. So it was actually pretty interesting to get reacquainted with what's obviously equally as important than the probability that your Game of Thrones character will make it to book 7. So I think everyone knows that it's probably not a great time to be a whale. But what I mean, let's call a spade. But what most people don't know is that the whole conversation about protecting endangered species, and this is, I had no idea about this, this whole conversation is almost entirely about data. So, you know, how many whales are there? It's actually pretty difficult to say, it turns out. What size whale population is sustainable? How many whales can be hunted without putting the population at risk? Like, it's numbers, numbers, numbers. But the problem, I guess, at least for most of the last century, is that those numbers didn't add up. The Soviet Union, in particular, finger wag, was covering up their illegal whale hunting and skewing the figures. And not to say that people didn't know that whaling was bad for whales. I mean, obviously, right? There was like a third of all sperm whales were killed in the last century and like 90% of blue whales, right? 90%. So the deal was, like, we didn't have the full picture until now, right? Earlier this month, three researchers, Robert Rocha, Philip Klapman, and Yulia Ivashenko? I'm sorry, Yulia. Totally destroyed that.
Ivashenko. I think that's good.
Ivashenko. All right. They published a paper that tallied up the count of all whale deaths using information from different databases around the world. And they found that nearly 3 million whales were killed between 1990 and 1999. 3 million. So no one had ever thought to try this before because the data from whaling commissions, so like these are the different commissions that are set up around the world to track whaling, basically, right? The numbers that they had just don't seem reliable. But that was before Ivashenko, one of the paper's authors, right, did a little digging and found that nearly 200,000 of the 500,000 whales caught by the Soviet Union were never reported. And so once that nut was cracked, everything started to add up. And this number, it turns out, really matters. The number of whales that were killed basically since people started whaling. Not only does it show what the oceans should be able to sustain, but it correlates a lot more closely with other research that used genetic modeling techniques. So they were using like the genetics of the whales to try and estimate the number of whales that existed before hunting started so that we could get some kind of comparison, right? Because if you can count the whales that are alive and you know how many whales used to exist before we started hunting them, then you have some idea about what kind of impact hunting has on their populations. But those numbers were always really different, right? The counted whale deaths and the this predicted initial population were not consistent at all. But because of this new research, the numbers are actually pretty close. So this is cool, right? It gets and the reason that I was so drawn to this, and the reason that I kind of jumped on it when Paul shared it with us was that it really gets to the heart of one of the hardest data science problems. So as much as it feels like there's data about everything that you'd ever want to know, and we talk about, you know, our smart homes and wearable gadgets and data, but it's really not just sitting around waiting to be explored. It turns out that until pretty recently, most of the the data we have is pretty sparse. It's not reliable. It's a lot of work to put together. But in this case, the researchers were able to pull it off, and now we have a much clearer picture about how whaling really jeopardized the existence of many of these species. So I think this, we're going to put this as a check mark in the win column. Go data science.
You know, what stood out to me in this particular story is the power of definitions in data science. And it is one of those things where if you ever want to seem smart in a meeting with a data scientist or someone who analyzes data, just ask them how they defined a particular variable, because so much of the crux of so many arguments are based on how people define stuff. So to give a very, very specific example, I was working with, I think there was some data from one humanitarian organization, and there was data from another humanitarian organization, and I was merging them, and I was running these analyses, and they didn't make any sense to me. And I realized that in both cases, I was running analyses on quote-unquote adolescents, and how each organization had defined what an adolescent was completely different, right? One was like 13 to 15, and the other one was like 8 to 24 or something like that. Like, it was just so crazy, but it was the power.
As in, like, one group knew what an adolescent was, and the other was like, I don't know, not
exactly. No, and this is this huge point that's like, there is so many parts of data science where the assumptions made by the analyst are embedded in the definitions, like what's a whale, what's a death, like that kind of stuff. Because it was like, well, we harpooned him and they survived, so we classified that as a death, but they didn't actually, you know, they didn't actually die, they just have a harpoon in them, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is 1,000 instances of this. This is like everything that you're like, oh no, you just count out the number of sails, and it's like, well, actually, sails is a pretty complicated concept. This is a very, very common part about data science, is how people define stuff. So it's kind of cool to see that, you know, put into the idea of whales and, like, you know, like what counts as a particular category of this and that kind of stuff. So touche, definitions are important. All right, last story, number 6, Uber, the big data company. So I don't know why I need to explain this, but I will. Uber is an incredibly popular transportation company that, while not owning any cars itself, connects people who need a ride with a driver who will take them for a ride. That's the sort of model. Somehow I kind of missed the Uber craze. I think I've only ordered like a single Uber, and I've probably ridden in 3 or 4 Ubers total, but not that many. But based on, you know, the many, many, many experiences of other people, there is a lot of people who rely on Uber a huge amount. And based on my experiences with taxis, and I've taken a huge number of taxis in my day, I am a huge Uber fanboy, because my my limited experiences have Uber, and everyone else's experience with Uber just vastly outweigh my experiences with taxis. So go Uber. But it is safe to say that while I probably only appear maybe once in Uber's database, because I think I only made one order, there are many people who use Uber multiple times a week. They have, at this point, hundreds of data points in their database. And these people are giving Uber a tremendous amount of valuable data about where they go and how much they spend and that kind of stuff. Now, the company is actually taking its first big step into creating value from that particular information. So this week, Uber announced that they are partnering with Starwood Hotels, which owns hotel chains like Westin and Sheraton and that kind of stuff. If you give permission, share your information, your Uber information, with the hotel chain. Specifically, they'll be linking your Uber account, which contains information such as, you know, where you picked up, where you dropped off, how much you paid, how far you traveled, that kind of stuff, with your Starwood preferred guest account, which I'm assuming is some kind of frequent flyer program for hotels. And, you know, as about a dozen articles have pointed out, the Starwood Hotels deal is just the beginning. There is little doubt that Uber will make more deals in the future with everyone they can, from airlines to restaurants to whatever. And, you know, the truth is that they are sitting on a really great amount of information. They know where their products, you know, where their customers go, where they go to spend money and that kind of stuff. And the idea is that they can use this to help other companies sell more money. Now, some people have actually leapt upon this move by Uber as another loss of privacy in the age of data, and that might be true, but that's actually not what I care about. Rather, what I'm actually really interested in about this move is that a company who provides ostensibly one product, right, connecting people who need to go from A to B with people who are willing to drive them from A to B for a fee, connecting those two people in a way that is both enjoyable and a great experience for them, but in addition, right, there's this second secret product, taking that customer's information and selling it to another company with the idea that that company will be able to upsell them on additional services. So it's actually this really interesting approach. When you think of Uber, you're going to think of them as the people who provide you with a car, but really they're the people who provide you with a car and then sell you to other people. And I think this is telling for such a company that has like a really narrow business model. Like you see them on the surface, you're like, okay, cool. They're the people who connect me with cars. They're the people who connect me with people who will drive me places. And, you know, I've always long suspected that in the future, all companies, and many companies who could possibly do this, will have this dual product strategy. They have the thing that they sell, and then they have a data about the people who buy what they sell, which they in turn sell to other people. And the part of it that I always remember this adage, right? If you're not paying for the product, you are the product, right? This is the classic belief. Like people talk about this for Reddit all the time. The idea that if you're using some platform for free, say Twitter, Google, or something like that, don't be surprised that that company is selling you or your data, your attention to another company to pay their bills. And it always struck me as odd because, you know, if you've ever played online poker or something very similar, people behave very differently in the free games versus the real money games, right? In the free money games, everyone's like bold and everyone's all in for every card and that kind of stuff because they have nothing to lose, right? It's easy. But in the real money games, people play completely different. So, and I've tried this, using player data from the free games to predict the behavior from the real money games is actually really, really, really basically impossible because people don't play the same way. In a similar vein, the data from people who use a free version of some software, some website, say Reddit or something like that, is a pretty terrible source of information to model the behavior of people who would actually pay to use something, right? Those are two different people. However, if you take an Uber trip from an airport to a hotel, they have three really important pieces of information from you. They have the fact that you were able to pay for a flight, you're able to pay for a hotel, and you're able to pay for the transportation in between. And anybody worth, you know, even with half a brain would ask, well, clearly they're willing to pay money when they travel. What else would they be willing to spend the money on? So in the future, I very much suspect that you could remove the first part of that adage. We are always the product. Our data, particularly if we're paying money for something, is a great piece of information that they will be willing to sell to other people through various deals to provide the, you know, provide that funnel for people. Okay, Chris travels, Chris spends money, he's staying at a Starwood hotel. How can you get him to spend a little bit more money? So regardless of whether or not you've paid for something, you are always going to be the product.
Yeah, I think that's true. And every company is a data company.
I actually love the idea of every company being a data company. I feel like that sort of encapsulates my argument much, much more clearly than I did. All right. Alas, listeners, the weekly 30 minutes, probably more towards 45 minutes or an hour at this point, where we confirm that Jonathan's imposter syndrome is actually just from his profound lack of skill. is true. So make sure to check us out next week for more great stories about data in the real world. Credit for the music you hear today always goes to Professor Click. Be sure to check us out on Twitter at PartiallyD and visit us on the interwebs at partiallyderivative.com. You can also follow me at Chris Albin and follow my co-host Jonathan something something at Jonathan Morgan. Have a great week, all.